Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is educator and writer Anthony DiRenzo. DiRenzo is an associate professor of creative writing in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. A fugitive from the advertising world, DiRenzo has published articles and essays in many literary journals, including Voices in Italian Americana. He is the author of several books, including the well-received Bitter Greens, Essays on Food, Politics, and Ethnicity from the Imperial Kitchen, and that was published in 2010. His most recent and the major topic of today's discussion is his first book of historical fiction called Trinacria, A Tale of Bourbon Sicily. It was published by Guernica Editions in late 2013. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me again here, Tish.
Now, Trinacria is a ghost story, as you have explained in certain places. And the protagonist is Marchesa Spinelli, known as Zita. Tell us about her. Tell us about the ghosts.
Donna Zita Spinelli, the Marchesa of Scalea, was a liberal aristocrat who ran salons and wrote epigrams and drew political cartoons in the Palermo area during the 19th century. As I imagine her, she was a Salinista, an intellectual, beginning life as a progressive and ending as a very bitter reactionary because of her disillusionment with the Italian Revolution. The ghost is both figurative and literal. She narrates the story from the crypt of the Capuchin catacombs at the west end of Palermo. But the real ghost is the death of the dreams of democracy that accompany the failure of the Italian Revolution. These ghosts are stirring all over Italy now, in fact, ever since the sesquicentennial of the Risorgimento, the Italian unification. Italy literally is falling apart at the seams as a country. It is shocking to see this. It's only been a united modern democracy since 1870, first as a constitutional monarchy, then within 60 years it became a totalitarian fascist dictatorship. After the Second World War, it became a republic. It voted out the monarchy. And the ghosts of all that unfinished business that happened when North and South became united, it really was a civil war very much like the American Civil War that in fact paralleled in years. And there are, in fact, a lot of economic and political connections between the two great conflicts.
How did you decide to make her the narrator on this? I found that really interesting, especially the ghost aspect. You know, she's talking very humorously from the tomb, I must say.
Well, when you're dead, you're literally beyond everything. It's what Nietzsche said. Every laugh is an epitaph for a feeling. So to cultivate what Cicerone called lontananza, to keep yourself very, very distant from things so that nothing hurts you. And when you're dead, I guess that is the ultimate form of lontananza. You are completely removed. You're just a spectator. And you see the world forward and backward as this sense of endless reruns. And the ghosts are partly autobiographical. I think that you know that my mother's family came to Sicily during the very late 17th, very early 18th century from Spain and landed in Bagaria, which is a seaside town about 15 kilometers due west of Palermo, which is noted for its very ornate villas. And the colonial administrative class lived there. And my mother's ancestors were those who helped first the Spanish and then the Bourbon viceroys rule Sicily. And a lot of the family history that is told in the novel is my mother's family's history.
Wow, that must have been amazing for you to be portraying history as well as historical fiction. I mean, most of this is real, right?
Most of this is real. In fact, I would dare say no more than 10 to 15% of the novel is made up. The film crew coming to Palermo is based very much on Luchino Visconti's 1962 shoot of Il Gatto Pardo, the historical epic film based on Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa's novel of the same name. And in fact, my mother and I visited the town of Villabatta, which is the central setting of Trinacria, my mother's hometown, a year after the shoot. So my mother had not been back to Sicily since 1946, and I was there with her. And while her relatives and former neighbors were entertaining us, they were talking about the shoot and they were talking about being involved in the movies, some as advisors, some as costumiers, most as extras. And most of these people playing extras requested that they play their ancestors, their great-grandparents on either side of the divide of the Italian Revolution. So here they are, like Civil War reenactors, playing their ancestors. And, you know, that is also an attraction here in the United States with reenactors trying to reconnect to their family histories. In that way. But one story that they told, and they told a lot of wacky stories about Visconti's perfectionism and how he literally tore apart Palermo to make it look like it was back in the 19th century. One hilarious anecdote concerned the town of Cimina, which is a mountain village about 25, 30 kilometers due south from Villabata. And this was the town that Luchino Visconti chose to be Donna Fugata, which in Lampedusa's The Leopard is the ancestral fief of the title character, the Prince of Salina, Prince Fabrizio. And this town is actually a very old, venerable town, has a wonderful history, has one of the best preserved temples of Demeter on the island. It's 2,500 years old. It's in nearly perfect condition. And Visconti came and he pillaged that ancient site to get marbles and stuff to build a set, palazzo for the imaginary prince, the make-believe please. After the rap, there was a delegation from the town that came to the party at the Hotel de Palms in Palermo, this beautiful Art Nouveau hotel. And they respectfully presented a petition to 20th Century Fox to please put back the set because tourists no longer wanted to see
the original
city. They want to see the Temple to Demeter. They want to see the palazzo where Burt Lancaster could pretend to be a Sicilian prince.
Oh, God.
Now, I heard that.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable,
isn't it?
Right, that make-believe. It means more than actual history.
Well, that's a real American problem in our own culture.
That's right. Public relations trumps everything, John Dos Passos says in the USA trilogy, and he's absolutely right. I thought that they were exaggerating because Sicilians, unlike Neapolitans, are very deadpanned in their humor. In fact, that probably goes back to the Normans conquering Sicily. So in many ways, Sicilians are very almost like British in that dry, hauteur, that sardonic, deadpan sense of humor.
Right.
So they're telling this story, this has got to be a story. But when I did my research, I found out it's absolutely true. In fact, all the most fantastic elements in the book are the ones that are the most accurate. It's the straightforward stuff to connect everything that I made up. So only the connective exposition is made up. Everything else is absolutely true. I can cite chapter and verse.
You know what? I want to talk to you about some of the other characters, too. I was really interested in the granddaughter, Regina.
Regina,
Zita's granddaughter. She was a real eccentric little girl.
She was an eccentric.
And unusually assertive for a little girl.
For that time and place. But then Sicilian women are notoriously fierce.
But this was not a woman. This was a great role model
she's
for girls.
A great role model for girls that at her first communion party, her much more conventional mother asks her to smile because no man will want to marry you if you don't smile. It'll spoil your face. And Regina very quietly goes over to the dessert table, takes a carving knife, and just scars her face. And now no man will ever have to look at me again. And she sits down and she finishes her dessert.
Well, why do you think the character felt that way, though? I mean, this was a real person, right? Regina?
Regina is based on certain real people, the way the Marchesa is based on actual person, the Duchess.
But why would a little girl be so negative about marriage and men at the age of 12?
I'd have to say for two reasons that she saw the rather insipid lifestyle that her playmates led, that they only expected to be decorative and wear their little pastel frou-frou dresses and not care anything. And she, like a lot of younger daughters of the aristocracy, was something of an intellectual, a bookworm, somebody who raids the libraries. And when you read for yourself and see life for yourself, you come to your own conclusions. And I guess an inspiration for this character was the title character of Dacia Mariani's historic novel, set in Bagheria, called The Silent Duchess, in which a young woman asserts herself through intellectual independence. But Regina, like a lot of progressive young aristocrats, is very much in love with the idea of the Risorgimento, which is the movement toward Italian unification that starts just after the Napoleonic Wars and eventually builds momentum to finally Italy is united. And what a lot of people forget is that Sicily played an important role in that movement. In fact, in the year of 1848, the great year of revolutions, the first great revolution in Europe, the one that got Marx and Engels to want to write the Communist Manifesto, took place in Palermo on January 17th, the birthday of the Bourbon King, some present that was for him to see all Palermo run in insurrection. The reason being that the British made their stronghold in Sicily during the Napoleonic Wars. And like a lot of English who come to Sicily, the viceroy, the governor, Governor Bendick, who then went to be the governor general of India, fell in love with Sicily and fell in love with the Sicilian people and no longer wanted to see this island shackled to a backward reactionary regime, and introduced all kinds of measures and actually arranged for Sicily's independence. Around 1812, gave them
which is what Regina was totally into.
And also the Marchesa also is part of that. But as soon as that occurs and you abolish primogeniture, which is makes sure that land doesn't pass only to the oldest person in the family, the oldest son in the family, the unintended consequences of those liberal reforms was actually to break up the huge estates. And with that came the closing of the common lands. And I'm sure this seems very, very familiar to you. You know the history of the Industrial Revolution in England. The same dynamics began to assert themselves, reproduce themselves in Sicily. So what starts out as being a liberal, liberatory revolutionary movement is co-opted very, very quickly by landlords, very quickly.
It essentially destroys the lifestyle that Regina and her mother
and her grandmother are trying to defend. That's
yeah.
Right.
Oh, how interesting. You know what I wanted to ask you, Anthony? Since so much of this is true, why did you decide to make this historical fiction, just to connect the lines? Well, why didn't you make it a true story instead of a historical fiction?
For two reasons. I don't think I could have done as great a job doing creative nonfiction as Raleigh Trevelyan, the English historian, the grandson, in fact, of G.W. Trevelyan, the great English historian and politician mm-hmm. who, in fact, mm-hmm. backed Garibaldi and wrote Garibaldi's first biography in English and wrote the definitive history of the Risorgimento from the English perspective from the early 20th century. His grandson wrote about this epoch and wrote about the Anglo-Sicilian colony in a beautiful book called Princes Under the Volcano, which is the main source for Trinacria. And the problem, the challenge would have been that the background would have overwhelmed the foreground in such a way that I could not tell a coherent story. So what I did was I took certain archival materials, blended them with my family history, and then tried to create a kind of intertextual dialogue, because the revolution's role in the South is a major theme in modern Italian literature.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Dorenzo. We're talking about his historical fiction, Trinacria, A Tale of Bourbon Sicily. Now, I want to talk to you also, how did you do research on this? I know you already had a vast knowledge of so many aspects of Italy because of your own background. What kind of research did you do? Did you actually have to go to Italy and look into the archives and so on?
What I tended to do was collect family lore and compare the family lore to the town lore of Villabatta and then both to the historic record. Where do they overlap? Where do they agree? Where do they contradict? And I found that it was where the contradictions occurred that was where the story was. That's where I wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, there is a family legend that is backed up by town lore that my great-grandfather, Antonino Cafaro, my namesake, had smuggled arms and supplies to Garibaldi and the Red Shirts up in the hills of the Concadoro just before the eve of the Siege of Palermo.
Wow.
And that Garibaldi then came and into Villabatta with small retinue to personally thank my great-grandfather and uttered the words then to his adjutant, Nino Bixio, Nino, oggi qui, domani a Palermo, today we're here, tomorrow Palermo. Now, every Villabattese will swear that occurred. It is a family story that has remained in my family for four generations. But if you look at the historic record, everybody claims that Garibaldi did not come down to Villabatta. In fact, you know, the Mount Grifone, where they were, you could either go down to Palermo through the Villabatta side or go through another town. And it is that town that has an obelisk that says, on this day, Garibaldi came and says, Nino, oggi qui, domani a Palermo. And so they have the monument, and we don't.
So which one do you obviously, well, obviously you believe one or the other, right?
Well, I would have, maybe, perhaps the truth is somewhere in between. It is more likely that my great-grandfather, who was progressive, was a Republican, even though he escaped the life of privilege in Bagheria, to start a life over again as an entrepreneur in Villabatta, probably went, it's you know, the Mohammed goes to the mountain. So most likely he and a lot of other Villabattese who I know, in fact, joined Garibaldi's troops in the siege of Palermo, probably went up to Gibil Rossa, that's the town. And that's where Garibaldi thanked him. But it's more dramatic for you to remember that Garibaldi would come to you and thank Nino.
You know, I think it's really interesting in this book, too, in the beginning of each chapter, the ghost from the tomb, Zita, is so funny.
Right.
She makes so many funny comments. It almost reminds me of a drag queen in modern-day San Francisco, you know?
Right, right.
These very funny things.
Well, she is performing life because she is out of it. And the idea of role-playing is very, very important.
But that came from you, right? I mean, there's no historical...
There is no...
dialogue.
There's no Marquesa of Scalea. I channeled this lady. but there are several counterparts to her. One is the Duchess of Santa Rosalia, Alessandra Spadafora, who married the English wine merchant, Benjamin Ingham, the great Marsala king. And so really Zita is based on her, on Alessandra, Don Alessandra, in looks, in temperament. In fact, when I found an old daguerreotype of Don Alessandra, I knew that I had my character. I held it in my hand, and then I heard my character's voice whisper in my ear. And that was it. There was that instant connection between artifact and imagination when I saw that.
Wow. I want to ask you about this, too. So many Americans are interested in their ancestors and looking into their backgrounds. You have turned it into a major passion. It's in all your writing. What made you so passionate about your Italian and Spanish relatives?
Well, in order not to want to look back, you have to be completely invested in being an American. And I never was. From very, very early on, for many, many complicated reasons, I've really never really considered myself an American, though I'm born here, and though certainly my political orientations are very, very American, I've never culturally felt like an American.
And why is that? Can you explain that?
Partly because I lived among mostly Sicilian immigrants and spoke Sicilian and Italian first 7-8 years of my life. But also when we moved to the suburbs, there wasn't this great welcoming committee to want to welcome me to mainstream America. Quite the opposite. You are not an American. What are you doing here? How dare you talk like that wear clothes like that or whatever? And that was a major turnoff, having teachers tell you that, you know, you people weren't even human until you came to these shores.
It's unbelievable.
Literally saying things like that.
That is such an immigrant story, too,
right.
And it's still going on
to
this day. Why did you stay here? I mean, it seems to me that with that kind of feeling, you would want to go live in your homeland.
Because nothing was left. Everything was destroyed during the war. That's why there was no going back. There was a moment in which there was last vestigial property in Sicily. My mother utterly begged my father to buy up that land and we could go there because she felt that Italy would have been better for me growing up as a person. But my father resisted, I think for very good reasons. And then that last of that land went, and so there was no there to go back to. So all my Sicilian relatives stayed in America, and one by one they all went mad or died terrible deaths or whatever, whereas all my father's relatives from the Abruzzi, which is another wonderful region of Italy.
That's a wine region, too, isn't it?
The Citra wineries are by the shore, but it's mostly grazing land. In fact, it is the Abruzzi is the Yosemite of not only Italy, but Europe. It's one of the last places in Europe where there are wild wolves, wild bears, eagles, all the mountain goats still running free. My Abruzzese relatives went back. They got their money and they went back. And so... And they were by far the happier relatives.
So you remain in touch with Italy and your Spanish
roots
by writing about it.
By writing about it.
Continuing to study about it.
Right, but you Skype. And now the idea of utterly cutting your ties, burning all your bridges, that is nonsense. First of all, it was never true. That if you look at the patterns of immigration, that more than half of the immigrants who came to America during the Golden Door period went back. Of those who stayed, more than half would shuttle back and forth between the two shores, had at least certainly an emotional double allegiance to America and to Italy. But you don't really hear that. You only hear about that one-way thing. So only maybe a third, perhaps even as little as a quarter, take that traditional Yankee Doodle Dandy route of going, being 100% American and going forward. And there's a reason for that. Any country, particularly a country with imperialistic aspirations, as America sadly has become, wants to uproot any kind of dissent.
Oh, absolutely. And they want you to assimilate.
They want
totally, 100%.
Completely. And to have another set of eyes by which to see the world makes you completely unmanageable. It's very much what Dr. Du Bois talks about in The Soul of Colored Folk.
I was going to say in regard to
that doubleness, that two-ness.
Yep.
And much to a lesser extent, of course, but immigration, persecution, and the twin failures of democracy. Democracy failed in Italy first. It's always been said that the reason immigrants came to this shore is that the Italians did not know how to experiment with capitalist democracy. And so Italy was behind the curve, but actually Italy did experiment with capitalist democracy and utterly ruined itself in the process and increased income gap and class divisions and all these other things. And one of the things that this novel and its sequel, After the Fair is Over, which is I'm working on, is trying to explode that myth that it was the collapse of a kind of 2008-style meltdown that caused immigration to occur. Not the other way around. Of course, also ethnic cleansing.
You know, I was going to ask you what lessons you want Americans to learn from this novel, and I knew you were working on a sequel to it. What are you trying to get people to notice in regard to this?
I think that the issues that we are embroiled in now regarding immigration, regarding national identity, regarding race and class and ethnicity, these are not new debates. They're very old. They go back at least 150 years. And if those of us who are hyphenated in America, Italian American, Irish American, German American, would remember that we were once caught in the middle of that, then I dare say our reaction to interpretation of America's place in the world, the issue of migrants in our own community, would be very, very different. You talked about why assimilation is so natural. You want to prevent that conversation from occurring right at the grassroots.
Yeah. No, I actually didn't say it was natural. I said it seems to be mandatory.
Yeah, mandatory.
Especially in the turn of the last century.
Right. There's nothing more unnatural than naturalization.
Yeah. Interesting. I do, before we run out of time, want to talk about the evolution of this book and how hard it was to get it published. You know, Guernica...
is a Canadian press.
And they had to raise money independently.
That's right.
Talk to us about that.
Well, I received 40 straight rejections. Nobody wanted to publish this book in America. To sum up, as one Italian-American editor put it, nobody wants to read about a Sicilian Marchesa unless she's written a cookbook. Which is an allusion to Anna Tosca Lanza, the Sicilian cooking marchesa who recently died and, in fact, helped Wegmans develop its Italian classic line. If you've read Bitter Greens, there's an essay in which the marchesa appears and is a major character in the essay. So the only press that would take it was Guernica Editions, which specializes in multi-ethnic post-colonial literatures of the world, first in Canada and then throughout the world. And it's a truly international press with a roster of some 500 authors, some of whom are very impressive indeed. You have Nobel nominees who are part. Dacia Mariani, for instance, publishes with Guernica Editions.
But they had to raise, you had to raise money from Indiegogo,
indeed, because
right?
The Ontario Ministry of Culture, which bankrolls Guernica, will not allow any monies to go to non-Canadian authors. So although they publish non-Canadian authors, these non-Canadian authors must provide their own money. But it can never be a direct contribution out of pocket, because that's a quid pro quo. That's more like a vanity press, which would violate Guernica's charter. So what I had to do was I had to find a sponsor, the Casa Belvedere Italian Cultural Foundation out in Staten Island. And they were kind enough to lend their name and their logo to online fundraising campaigns. And in exchange, the royalties go to them. Because Casa Belvedere, unlike a lot of Italian civic groups, was very much interested in being honest about and addressing the inequalities of the Risorgimento's heritage in the South. And during the sesquicentennial year, they had a series of debates culminating in a podcast by two Italian authors, one from the North, one from the South, talking about the troubled legacy of unification. And so they naturally became the sponsor for this project.
Oh, that's great. That seems to be the way publishing is going. People have to figure out all these new avenues on which to do it. We only have a couple minutes left. Can you tell us just a tiny bit more about what the sequel is going to be and when it might be coming out?
I need to finish it, and I'm hoping that it will come out by 2016, which is actually the 130th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty, and then the 30th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty restoration drive. And the book is about Donizetti's great-grandson, Attilio, who comes to America from Villa Bata. His father made carriages in Sicily. He gets on the ground floor of the Franklin Automobile Company, makes horseless carriages in America, and dreams of being a merchant prince like the Florio boys back in Palermo's Belle Epoque. How that does not work out, and how he is enamored and then ultimately destroyed by the American dream is the subject of that book.
Oh, that should be interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, we will look forward to that. Can you give some contact information? People can get in touch with you.
People may reach me at dorenzo@ithaca.edu. But if they would like to order a copy of Trinacria, Tale of Bourbon Sicily, they can go right to Guernica Editions website and order a copy there, and also through Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and of course, Buffalo Street Books, where I'll be having a reading on May 10th at 3 p.m. And it's a perfect day because it's the eve of the anniversary of Garibaldi's invasion of Sicily.
Okay, great. Well, Anthony Dorenzo, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Trinacria, A Tale of Bourbon Sicily. Thank you so much for enlightening us about this really important issue. Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.